Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
The Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962. It is a vast window on the Cold War and on the misunderstandings, misstatements, mistakes that were made by the leaders of several nations, most notably the Soviet Union and the United States. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Serhii Plokhii, a professor at Harvard University and the author of the new book, Nuclear Folly, A History of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We begin with the drama of dramas. It is October 16th, 1962, approximately 8 a.m. at the White House. McGeorge Bundy, former Harvard dean, now the National Security Advisor, enters President John F. Kennedy's bedroom. Mr. Kennedy, I learned from Professor Plokhii, enjoys reading the Sunday papers before he gets out of bed. Mr. Bundy has very bad information for the president that upsets him. Professor, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. What does McGeorge Bundy tell President Kennedy that morning? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John, and thanks for having me on your show. It's a real pleasure. Bundy is bringing the news that are not in the newspapers. And again, we are in a very different place compared to our today's world. It's 1962, and news are not spread with the help of Twitter and or Facebook. So the news are at least 24-hour old. And what Bundy brings, he brings the news that are not in the newspapers, and that is that the Soviet potentially nuclear-armed ballistic missiles were spotted a day and a half before that on the territory of Cuba by American reconnaissance plane U-2. The immediate reaction from the president of the United States at that point is, he can't do that to me. He later would actually call Khrushchev SOB. So it's a surprise, it's a disappointment, it's disgust. And the reaction of that kind is there because a few days earlier, Kennedy went on air and said that, well, if the Soviet missiles of that kind, ballistic missiles, would be spotted on Cuba, we would respond. And now he's on the spot. The missiles were there. He didn't expect that they would be there. He has to respond, but how to respond, this is a big question. He doesn't know the answer. And the rest of the day, he is actually struggling with that. He makes his assistants work on that. And this is the beginning of a really nightmarish, at least 1 week, and then additional second week and third week and fourth week. So this is a really dramatic moment in the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The U.S. president learns about the missiles and doesn't know what to do about them.
The newspapers in front of the president, when he learns from McGeorge Bundy about the missiles in Cuba, the newspapers are filled with criticism of John Kennedy because he has not responded more forcefully to the discovery early in September, around Labor Day, of Soviet ground-to-air missiles, defensive missiles. We call them SAMs. He did not respond in any forceful fashion except for to through a press release by his press secretary, Pierre Salinger, to say there's a red line here. And as long as they're defensive weapons, that's acceptable. But if they're offensive weapons, and he allows Dean Rusk to not define offensive weapons, then we will respond. President Eisenhower is on the campaign trail. We're building towards the midterm elections. And many of the decisions made at the White House these next days will be political decisions. It's what I learned from the professor. There's the military and there's the political, and oftentimes the political triumphs in the conversations in the days ahead. Eisenhower in particular is out there indicating to a very large audience that President Kennedy is weak. Weak. Now, later on that morning, 11:50 a.m., according to the professor's reporting, in the White House, a gathering of the Eagles. Robert Kennedy, the attorney general, the president's younger brother, McNamara, the defense secretary, Bundy, the national security advisor, Dean Rusk, the secretary of state. The man missing is John McCone. Who was he, professor?
Well, he was the head of the CIA. And it's a very, very interesting figure to see what was happening before anybody else in the government was able to do that. And, well, that's what is expected from the CIA head. But that certainly wasn't the case in many other situations. But in this case, McCoy was talking as early as August about the possibility of the Soviet ballistic missiles on Cuba. And he was not there because he got married. He got married and he was on his honeymoon. So missing that all important part of the crisis, the beginning of the crisis, he was on French Riviera. He was in contact with his deputies at the CIA, was trying to influence the situation by communicating to those deputies. But again, his absence there in the White House, his absence next to the president was a major problem for the crisis. And you mentioned the newspaper and their coverage of Kennedy. Yes, indeed, he was perceived to be a weak president. He had, from the perspective of many in the U.S. and in the Soviet Union, he was an apprentice. He didn't have an experience of leading anything. Really, apart from his presidential campaign, his previous political career was in the Senate, and his international relations experience was quite limited as well. And Eisenhower was pointing to that, and that was additional pressure on Kennedy to react. And as we see, he was ready to overreact because he believed that his presidency was online.
Right.
One of the first comments that he made was to his close advisor, Dan Powers, was that, well, Senator Keaton will be the next president. So this is the first reaction that anybody hears from the president on the news about the discovery of the Soviet missiles.
His Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, lays out the two options that will be on the table for the next weeks. The first is to strike the missiles now, airstrike. The second is to build up and preparation for a quarantine, a blockade. Those two are immediately Dean Rusk's mind. There will be divisions of those. What kind of strike? When is the invasion? What kind of blockade? What do we do over these next days? But the Secretary of State lays it out right away. Significantly, later in the day, the president's leaning towards airstrike right now. Immediately. Don't make any announcement. We said there was a red line. He crossed it. He calls him an immoral gangster. We're going to attack. Adlai Stevenson, then the ambassador to the United Nations and a previous presidential candidate, losing twice to Eisenhower, but an esteemed member of the Democratic Party, comes to the president and says, we can find a peaceful way out of this, Mr. President. But what I learned from you, Serhii, is that Kennedy wanted to hit right away. He was a hawk immediately. Who talked him out of it? Do we know why he backed off that first day?
Well, he was the hawk. And this is something that at least came as a major surprise to me. This is not the image of the President Kennedy that we get from the memoir of his brother, Robert Kennedy, who, again, another major surprise, was actually the most hawkish member of the what would later become the executive committee. From those memoirs, we also don't hear much about Dean Rusk, but Rusk was the person, or Adlai Stevenson. So those were the people who were not hawks at all, who were really pushing for some form of a diplomatic solution to the crisis. But the president's gut feeling at that point, because of this political pressure on him, because of him being portrayed as a weak president, his immediate reaction was to strike.
Right.
To show that he was a strong president, to also express his really, really dissatisfaction with Khrushchev, because Khrushchev, through back channels, was indicating to him that he would do nothing to upset President Kennedy's and the Democratic Party's chances at the fall elections to the Senate. So all of that is happening also within a particular political calendar. And that political calendar, I would say, is the most important part of President Kennedy's calculation. So at the end, it's the pushback from his advisors, including McNamara in particular, who were advocating the blockade quite early on, that makes President Kennedy to back off and think about setting the structure, discussing the issue, and then eventually arriving to the conclusion. And it was 1 week of negotiations between the president and his advisors that led to the blockade eventually.
We know all of this in detail because the professor reveals that the secret tapes were running. Kennedy knew of them. Bobby Kennedy, we can guess, knew of them, but we have quotes here. And oft times, because I've listened to the audio of the professor's book as well as read the book, and I recommend the audio, you can hear the narrator, very, very skilled, take on the accent or the tone of Jack Kennedy. You can actually hear him talking. And it's chilling to see how little they knew and how much they had to guess. At the end of this first day, Bobby Kennedy polls informally there were nearly 20 of them there, I think 18 or 20 of them present, state, defense, and National Security Council. It was 11 for a blockade and 7 plus 2 for a strike. The two were Bobby and Jack Kennedy. When we come back, we're going to turn to the other side of the story, the presidium. This man, Nikita Khrushchev, whom Kennedy calls an immoral gangster. What do we need to know about his approach? How is it that we came to this crisis in 1962? The book is Nuclear Folly, a history of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's as scary today as it was then, more so because we have more information about how ill-informed the leadership was in both sides. Serhii Plokey is the author. I'm John Batchelor.